normalizations of relations. Because as for the thinking of some circles in Thailand, this is the beginning of the reconciliation between the communist big powers that, if succeeded, should be profitable to the Vietnamese in this region. And it should be profitable to the international communism in the final, in this region. Some say that Thailand should leave Vietnamese establish the Federation of Indochina without any of Thai intervention. But as for my opinion and the opinion of some other Thais, Vietnam is exercising imperialism in Indochina, not creating the federation. Because as we have learned or we have known, the mean to establish the federation is the consensus. I mean the consensus of states. The best example is the American system of federation that occurred in the late 1780s. It was created by the consensus of 13 states with the respect of their equal rights and liberty, and without the using of force. But what the Vietnamese have done and do now is in Indochina is imperialism, which is not recognized by the international law and the law of civilized nations and by the international community. I am sure the Thais would greatly appreciate if the United States put some more visible, concrete attention for the sake of this region and cooperates more strongly with the Thais and other non-communist ASEAN countries to bring back the order to this region and without a doubt to prevent hegemonism in this region. And if it is also the initiative of the U.S. to realize the international guarantee of the permanent neutrality of the two states of Laos and Cambodia, we would feel more grateful to the United States. The third development I will say briefly. The Cambodian refugees and the other Indochinese refugees have caused and still cause great burdens for the Thai. Now there are nearly 200,000 Indochinese refugees, of which the large number are the Khmer people, which stay in Thai territory. The Thai government has to receive these refugees on the humanitarian principle. The burdens shared by the international community are not enough. The Thai government had to pay much of her own budget each year for solving this problem, which has been and is now caused by the Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia. The Thai government and the Thai people feel that why Vietnam has caused great sorrow to the mankind in this region, and Thailand still bear the heavy burdens of the Indochinese refugees. The US and Western powers become to be less interested in sharing us these burdens. So the Thai government seems to feel rather disappointed with the reluctant or the hesitant attitude of the US and Western countries on this problem. In conclusion, the Indochina factor may have positive or negative effects on Thai-US relations. On the negative effect, it might lead to the more effectiveness of the communist expansionism in the region of Southeast Asia. That means the interests of the US and the free world would be lost from the region. Thailand and other ASEAN nations would be forced to be under the umbrella of the communists instead of their standing confidently with the US in the free world. On the positive effect, it might lead to the more closer relations between the US and Thailand, including other non-communist countries in the region, in order to preserve the liberalism and the international order in the region. But that depends much on the good and attractive attention of the US government. Thank you.
Yes, our last presenter is Doug Pike.
Yes, last dog to be hanged. Last barrier between you and the Murray Woods. I really hope you get there because it really is a magnificent trip. Years ago when I was in journalism school here, I covered the visit of General Charles de Gaulle to the Muir Woods, and I remember his aide remarking that in his many years of association with the general, this was the first time he had ever seen him reduced to silence. It's, you know, there are huge towering trees, and it's like an outdoor cathedral, and it really is awe-inspiring. It's not a trip to be missed. Well, to move from the Muir Woods to Vietnam, sublime to the ridiculous. The centerpiece of my paper is on page 10. It has to do with the, what you might call the operational code of the Politburo. And I think when I expand this, or redo it, I'm going to expand this section. And if I could leave simply one thought or one perception with you this morning, it would be that you should be aware that there is in Hanoi today a very dynamic condition in terms of policy, in terms of perceptions, in terms of doctrinal disputes, in terms of Bung Di, or faction bashing, which is the style of politics in Hanoi. And this is between the ideologues and the pragmatists, the general term we use on the outside, and they also tend to use this within themselves in their own ranks. And the cross reference is the term, the pejorative terms, which the pragmatists use against the ideologue being a pro-American, and the pejorative term used by the pragmatists against the ideologues being war lovers. What this has to do essentially with how to handle the Americans, how to handle the policy problems in Cambodia, how to handle Thailand, how to deal with ASEAN as a group. And the central issue is whether the ideologues would argue a kind of stonewalling, sustained application of force and pressure, that they would argue everything Vietnam has ever gotten in the past, that's the way they've gotten it, and that this will in the long run pay off and ought to be the policy approach pursued. Whereas the pragmatists argue for a more manipulative, softer approach, arguing that you can get more with a carrot than you can with a stick. And neither side, of course, can demonstrate perfectly that their policy approach is correct. And in the past, the weight has always been on the side of the ideologue. And it's now, I think, shifting back to its not exactly in balance, but it's more indeterminate now. The memory, I think, collective memory of the Politburo in the last 10 years has been that nothing has worked very well. And there's a great loss of certitude in their confidence in being able to obtain what they want and to prevail. Now that mindset ought to be borne in mind by everyone dealing with Hanoi. And I've heard a great deal here in the last several days that indicates that this condition in Hanoi is not even being attended to. Particularly this was in the Weatherby paper, but other comments too that look at the U.S.-Thai-ASEAN problems with relation to Indochina, particularly Cambodia. They see a kind of endlessness. They see a sense of futility, weakness, clouds on the horizon, and it's an analysis that's done entirely by looking at our side and not looking at the other side. And it's a very dangerous thing to do because it's a kind of monodimensional analysis. And if anything that is done with respect particularly the focal point of Indochina today, which is Cambodia, simply must take into consideration the thinking, the mindset, the political orientations within Hanoi. And as I say, this is spelled out, I intend to spell it out a good deal more in detail but the heart of it is on page 10. Also, a couple of errors. I've got the wrong government on page 12, not the wrong prime minister. We did catch that. We did send a telegram to Bangkok. I
out.
Sure, in the Thai versions, whether this is correct or not. Also on page 12, or page 8, I've been, some people who have read this have seen this as my saying that I see that there is a great policy dispute in Vietnam, or in Washington today, about dealing with Vietnam. And in rereading it, I can understand how they come to this conclusion. I will also try to correct this. I did not mean to say that that there is a raging debate in Washington about Vietnam. Actually, I don't think they're thinking about it at all, one way or the other. I mean, I'd be closer. We probably have a majority of the people in Washington who think about Vietnam in this room right now. But what I did mean to suggest is that based on my sessions and conferences in Washington, there does seem to be a sharply differing perceptions of the nature of the problem, a kind of restiveness with American policy, but it isn't reached the height of criticism because nobody really has a clear counter suggestion, but there is a kind of, among analysts at least, a kind of dissatisfaction or a restiveness about whether our present policies really are what we want, and are they really designed? They've done pretty well by us in the past 10 years, but are they going to continue to serve us? That I will redo. Page 15 has the general conclusions. With respect to U.S.-Thai relations and Indochina, I think the most important thing to say is that while we differ in terms of geography, heritage, national interest to some, there are differences geographically. Obviously, we're very distant, and Thailand, as Joseph Onandi says, lives in a bad neighborhood. There is difference of heritage. Thai relations with Vietnam goes way back into history. Ours is really very short, as history goes. And there's differences, certain differences in national interest. But the basic fact is, I think, that U.S.-Thai interests with respect to Vietnam are more congruent and more identical or parallel than almost any other case I can think of. In talking about Vietnam to Thais, I'm more comfortable. I'm more at ease. I find we have a good deal to argue about, but we don't have perceptional differences. It's easier for me to talk to Thais about Vietnam than it is for me to talk to Americans in most cases. So the basic point is, of all the things that there are to argue about in the world, this really is one of the least of them as far as American policy is concerned. There are, this is more true, I think, in terms of present and short-term interests and prospects. There are two longer range problems that I think that are not necessarily going to divide us, but which are going to be a mutual concern to us. One is the China factor, and the other is the future political configuration of Indochina problem. I'm not a sinologue, but I feel uneasy now, and for reasons I'm not sure why, that we may be on the verge of witnessing a major change of policy by China with respect to Indochina, with respect to Vietnam, with respect to Cambodia. Some of the ASEANs here have, in earlier conferences, have pointed out that historically the Chinese changed their policies every 5 years, beginning in 1947, really. This is true. They are, if there's anything I do know about the Chinese, is that they're unpredictable, and they have a genius for switching policies without anybody really anticipating what they're going to do. that's not much help in the way of analysis. Just be ready to dodge, but you don't know which way you're going to dodge. But and it may be that, that this, in fact, is I'm seeing something that isn't there. The Chinese assert, of course, that they're determined to stay the course in Cambodia, and they assure everyone, and this may indeed be the case. But I simply have a kind of unease that something may be in the mill, something may be moving in this respect. If there are anyone who has any ideas on this, I'd certainly like to hear them. The other problem, and I think it really is the central long-range problem, has to do with the future political configuration of Indochina, whether it's to be a federation, a confederation, independent nations, non-aligned, or what. And the point I would make here is mainly that I do not feel that there has been sufficient thinking, either by the Americans or the Thais, in terms of what are the alternatives. I think there's a tendency to be a focus on what are symptoms of the problem and not the problem itself. Getting the Vietnamese out of Cambodia, that seems to be the end result objective of policies, and that really isn't the problem. I mean, I think that could be done, it's at least in theory, but that's not what you address, the question of getting. You have to address some more fundamental issues. There is a tendency, I think, to be seduced by the trivial, particularly in dealing with Cambodia. The whole issue of sending $5 million worth of arms to the non-communist Khmer is an example of this. Not really important at all in itself, not important in terms of balance of forces or in determining the outcome of the war. Important in terms of psychological and perceptual. And again, this is, as I think I've said, some of you heard earlier here, I've said that for the U.S. has had a gauntlet thrown down by ASEAN now, calling on us to ship some guns to the non-communists. And this is being watched very carefully in Hanoi. They have made certain moves, I would argue, very recently in trying to deter us, try to shunt this off on our part. But whether we send them or not is not, the guns or not, is not so important as how we handle it. And in this balance between the ideologues and the pragmatists, whether we contribute to the ideological position that you would say, you see, they're beginning to weaken. All we've got to do is keep on this sort of wall of pressure, and eventually we're going to get what we want. And that, I would argue, from our U.S. and Thai position, is helping the wrong elements in Hanoi. So it's not whether you do send the guns or not is not important. It's how you handle it, and it's how this is perceived in Hanoi that is what really counts. And this is true, of course, of so much of our behavior. If the U.S.-Thai-ASEAN coalition can remain determined and sort of this mindset of a 50-year war thesis, we're prepared to last this as long as that, then we'll begin to tip the balance in Hanoi, and I think we'll get a more forthcoming approach. I don't think there'll be anything, I cannot see it at least, a major change in Hanoi until there's some kind of a generational transfer of power, until some of the major figures go and are replaced. But that, if you look at an insurance table, company's actuarial table, should be fairly soon. And it may be very soon that we are approaching something of the same phenomena that apparently is underway in Moscow with a newer, younger leadership beginning to move in. I guess that sort of once over lightly. Back to you, Paul.
Okay. Thank you. I've been asked by our general chairman here, Professor Scalapino, since if I would make a few comments, I guess partly by the way of replying to comments I didn't hear yesterday, partly by way of replying to some specific things that have been said in the papers, and particularly to speak to this question, perhaps falling into the danger that Doug Pike just cited of being seduced by the trivial, but speak to this question of $5 million, as he puts it, of weapons, U.S. weapons for the resistance. And I'll try to keep my comments short, and then we might have a time for a few back and forth before a coffee break, when Bob, at about a quarter of?
I think so.
Okay. First, I would like to just make two very general comments, and I can't address them in anything like the detail they deserve. But I would like to, first of all, take as strong exception as possible to the notion, as put in one paper, but I've seen it in others, that it is extra-regionally based threats that drive our policies in Southeast Asia, that we are preoccupied with the Soviets, and that this is the whole basis of our Southeast Asian policy. I don't know how you go about refuting it except to say this is not what we say, it is what our critics say of us. It is the kind of thing you can read in Merdeka on a daily basis, but it's not the kind of thing you read if you read speeches by the Secretary of State, or even for that matter, surprising though it might sound, by the Secretary of Defense. Indeed, the United States is strongly aware of the importance of comprehensive security or national resiliency, to use terms that are common in Asia, fully aware that the great threat to the region does not come from a few Soviet ships in Cameron, which for that matter we can handle, but comes from the question of internal strength of the governments, and particularly if one is talking about an external threat, the threat of Vietnam and its million-man army. We are in no doubt about that. I think if you read what we say or look at what we do, you will understand that. It doesn't mean there is no Soviet threat, and it doesn't mean we're going to stop talking about developments in Cameron Bay, which have to be of concern to everybody. But I don't think it's correct to say that we are driven by concern about the Soviets. And for that matter, I would say, and here I don't think our statements quite do us justice, but I think we see the strategic importance of Southeast Asia as something that far exceeds anything you measure in simple the simple kinds of maps that strategists like to draw that show oil routes going through the Straits of Malacca and concluding, therefore, it's of great strategic importance. I don't mean to diminish the importance of those strategic lines of communication. They are important, though I'm not sure what it would cost for Japan, for example, to simply have to go around it and go by another route. What it would cost all of us if Southeast Asia were to go off of the very promising course that it's managed to get itself on in the last 10 years and go the way of the more dismal scenarios for the Philippines is the loss of a whole region of great vitality, great dynamism. As I point out regularly to Americans, a combined population of the six ASEAN countries, it exceeds that of Japan by a wide margin. A combined GNP of the six ASEAN countries, it exceeds the GNP of China, with whom so many Americans are so fascinated. This is a vital and important part of our, first of all, our own interests and our own relations, and it's a vital important part of the strategic balance in the broadest sense in East Asia, and it's in that sense that we have to be concerned about it. Strategic sea lanes are important, but they're not the main thing. I'd also like to just say briefly on the economic issues that we've heard a lot about. I can't get into the kind of detailed discussion that might be appropriate, and I can't say that our record is without fault or failing, and in fact, I wish very strongly that in the particular area of textiles, we could be more forthcoming and that protectionism in the United States were not quite as strong as it is. I might note that in the case of textiles, we're talking about the area that contains two of our four biggest organized labor unions, nearly 2 million Americans employed in this sector, which may be bizarre for a developed country, but that is the way it is, spread rather uniformly over a wide area of great political influence and importance, and suffering still from the effects of severe unemployment in that sector in 80, 81, 82. It is a major political problem for any U.S. government. And in the face of that, the fact that our textile imports from the developing world, our textile imports, mostly from the developing world, have grown by roughly 40%, I believe, is the figure in the last year, and by a larger percentage from ASEAN, I think is a sign that if we're being protectionist, we're not doing a terribly good job of it. In fact, those of us who are trying not to be protectionist take some comfort from that. I'm not saying that the record is clean. I think I've said that. But we've done a lot. I would note, and when it's said that certain things are discrimination against ASEAN, I would underscore on matters like the sugar quota, The problem is we would love to discriminate in favor of ASEAN if we could have our way. That's what you would see happening. But we have not a protectionist quota, but it happens that because our market is protected, it's the only place in the world that it really pays to sell sugar. That privilege gets rationed out. It gets rationed out among many countries, and there's just not much way to adjust it, unfortunately. But in fact, I can point to evidence of discrimination in favor of ASEAN, and just to pick the one that I think is of true economic significance, and that came in the renewal of our trade bill last year, where we were, despite strong efforts in the Congress to the contrary, we were able to get GSP renewed for another 8 years with very minimal provisions for graduation. That, again, is not the act of a protectionist country. It was not an easy thing to do in the United States during an election year. I think the man who deserves the most credit of any individual for that is Ambassador Brock, who I must say is going to be missed as he leaves that job. But I know Ambassador Brock's own attitudes are very strongly shaped by his very positive view of the ASEAN countries and his very strong view that what ASEAN is doing is the kind of thing we should support. So it's not a perfect record, but I think it's a better record and one with more specific concern about ASEAN than sometimes I've heard. On a specific issue about support for the non-communists, first let me make some general observations. One, I've heard comparisons made here and other places that we are suggesting some kind of difference between this group of freedom fighters, the non-communist Khmer, and freedom fighters in Afghanistan or in Nicaragua. We aren't and we don't. And if you read the speech Secretary Shultz made in San Francisco only a few weeks ago on the whole subject of support for freedom fighters, you'll see some very strong expressions of support for the non-communists in Cambodia. But there are some differences, and it just doesn't make sense to ignore those differences. And I will mention the most important difference is that the Mujahideen are fighting inside Afghanistan on a massive scale against massive Soviet force, and their requirements for arms, ammunition, and weapons far exceed anything that the non-communists in Cambodia have yet been able to make use of. That is a simple fact, and I might say in saying so, I am neither confirming or denying, to use the famous phrase, that we do anything in Afghanistan. But I am pointing out that the scale of requirements in Afghanistan is just on a different order of magnitude. If the non-communists can grow and be effective, then to some extent that will change. I think it would never reach the comparable level, but it is different, and therefore there is a necessary difference in our policy. And in the case of Nicaragua, and I don't mean to drag it into this discussion any more than I have to, but I'd point out that our problem in Nicaragua is that if we do nothing, no one else does anything. Fortunately, that's not the case in Cambodia. It's a luxury, perhaps, for our policy, but it's an important fact, and it shapes what we do. Second general point, we do strongly support the ASEAN strategy, including strongly support the ASEAN approach of strengthening the non-communist resistance. That support is not just rhetorical support. It takes, we put our money where our mouth is in many important ways, though not in directly providing weapons for the resistance. We do provide significant, substantial military assistance for Thailand. In fact, if you compare what we were doing in 1980 to what we are proposing today, you will see nearly a tripling in military assistance from roughly 30 million in 1980 to over 100 million today. We're trying to improve the terms of that assistance because we realize that the enormous financial burdens Thailand is under. We are trying to see ways in which we can, in fact, we are pursuing ways at the moment of expediting some of the shipments of equipment so that they can be in Thailand in the present emergency. We have responded positively, albeit reluctantly, to Thailand's request for F-16 aircraft. Reluctantly because we recognize the competing needs. We have certainly not been out pursuing the interests of American aircraft manufacturers. We have been responding to strong, urgent requests from the government of Thailand. And after what perhaps some would say was too long a delay, though I think it was appropriate, we went ahead to Congress just 2 weeks ago, Jim, is that right? With a request for approval for F-16s. Not something, unfortunately, that will be all that popular with some of the same congressmen who are urging us to do more for Cambodia. But I point out to them that it is part of the same picture. We are the major contributor to UN border relief operations, to the International Red Cross on the border. We are strongly supporting the resettlement of refugees, and Mr. Sompong's comments are very pertinent, and the concerns expressed in there, I understand, are very real. But the fact that our resettlement numbers are declining is not in itself a cause for alarm, because in fact the new arrivals are declining far faster than that. We are producing each year a significant net reduction in the number of refugees in Thailand. We have the difficult problem of residual people that have not been accepted anywhere for resettlement. But it's difficult not because we're unwilling to solve it, but because we all recognize that if we created the impression that anyone who comes to Thailand is guaranteed resettlement, you would have a flood of new people, and we are trying, working with you, to hold those levels down. And finally, we are very strong in our political support for the whole ASEAN strategy, including political support for the non-communists, in votes at the UN, in securing meetings between Sihanouk and Son Sann and the president, and things of that kind. And thirdly, third general comment, we strongly believe that the non-communists should be strengthened. And we believe that they should have weapons. We don't take any absurd position that somehow weapons for the non-communists are wrong. Very much the contrary, we think they're right. The issue is who should provide them. And it is a matter of public record that we have urged the Chinese, for example, to do more in the way of providing weapons for the non-communists and not to put so much of their effort into supporting the Khmer Rouge. I don't know whether it's those representations that have had any effect, but I do think there's been some shift already in China's policy in that regard. We, in fact, are looking ourselves now at the possibility of some direct non-military support to the non-communists in the form of a kind of AID program that would provide training and basic skills, particularly such skills as medical training, some administrative managerial skills, some that would be relevant to the immediate problems of the resistance, others that would be relevant to the time of a political settlement, to building up the kind of political cadre and administrative cadre that would be necessary, I think, if they're to hold their own weight. So the issue is not a matter of opposing materiel support. The issue comes down to the question of supplying weapons. And our conclusions on that point at this time, and I emphasize at this time, are drawn from a belief that there is not a shortage of weapons for the resistance at present. That conclusion is crucial, and if one drew a different conclusion, many of the calculations of costs and benefits that we see would perhaps come out differently. But the fact that the major camps have all fallen before the Vietnamese is not proof that more weapons are needed. In fact, it's absurd to think that the resistance could have held those camps. It was not their strategy. It should not be portrayed as a military defeat that they withdrew in the face of what had to be overwhelming Vietnamese force. Indeed, the key question now is whether the resistance can succeed in doing what it has professed to want to do for a number of years now, and that is to successfully mount operations into the interior. And in that regard, I believe it is the conclusion, particularly of those who work most directly with them, that their immediate needs are not for weapons. Their immediate needs are for training, for strategy, for plan of action. And I would point out, in terms of this whole question of need, it is a fact that from wherever the weapons are coming, it is a fact that the non-communist resistance has grown substantially over the last 5 years, from just a few thousand at the time of the formation of the KPNLF to estimates putting it in the between 20 and 30,000 and growing toward the larger number. So the resistance is growing. That's a development that we welcome. If it were not growing, we would look at it, I think, differently. So a very good rule to apply here is never say never, and we are not saying never. We are not saying no in principle. We are saying no, not at the moment. But in doing so, it's a delicate balance of costs and benefits. The benefits, I think, have to be considered largely symbolic, and in saying that, I don't mean to depreciate them. Symbolism, signaling, diplomatic effects can be more important than any specific material need. And I think if I had to list the benefits as I perceive them, starting with the most important, I think the most important is as a signal of support for Thailand. It has, to some extent, been defined as a kind of a litmus test. I think, in a way, that's unfortunate. But it has happened. That's a fact that we take account of. And certainly, if there's any single thing that is most inclined to change our perception of the issue at this time, it is precisely the representations we've had from the Thai government, and in a, I would emphasize, much more ambiguous way in the communique of the ASEAN foreign ministers. A second good reason is to give a signal of morale support for the non-communists at a time when they are hurting badly, when they need to get themselves back on their feet and get themselves effectively operating in the interior of Cambodia. But there's some question marks here as well as, or some negatives, I suppose, as well as benefits. And the negatives, I guess I would summarize by saying I think there's too great a tendency on the part of people, particularly Sun San himself, to avoid hard questions of military strategy and focus instead on the question of U.S. military support. And this danger that Doug Pike pointed to of being seduced by the trivial is a very real danger. And I think one can send a false signal here as well as a helpful one. And finally, there is the argument of a signal to Hanoi. And I strongly agree with what Doug Pike said, that the signals we're interested in sending to Hanoi are the signals that say that the war lovers, to use that term, are making a mistake, that this strategy is not going to win in the long run, I think are the right signals to send, though I have some question about how effective this particular one would be. And that leads me to try to say very briefly what I think the costs are, because I do think, on balance, the costs are greater at this stage still than the benefits. And here I don't give necessarily an order of importance, but an order of presentation. The first cost is the tendency to make this an East-West issue, a superpower issue, to get the journalists to start writing about the U.S.-backed resistance in Cambodia, to get the cause presented not as an ASEAN cause, but as a United States cause. I think that has serious negative consequences in many areas. I think it will eventually, could have some costs in the UN, which is not a body I'm inordinately respectful of, but it is a body where we put a lot of effort into securing good, substantial votes that are symbols, important symbols. I think its greatest potential damaging effect is in ASEAN itself. And I have to defer to the, and I'm very interested, in fact, in the comments of others here, particularly as to the reaction in Thailand and whether the reaction in Thailand is unmixed. But I do have a feeling that the reaction in Indonesia would be at best mixed and probably strongly negative, or at least negative, that there are already those in Indonesia who are unhappy with the ASEAN foreign minister's appeal, who are anxious, perhaps as a result of that unhappiness, to emphasize its ambiguities and to emphasize that it does not call for the United States to provide military support, but is a more general kind of statement. I don't think it helps in the long run in keeping Indonesia on board this strategy, and I think ASEAN unity here is a crucial ingredient to have the United States appear to take a dominant role. Secondly, I think there are some negative effects on Hanoi, and I think one of those negative effects is that defining this as a U.S.-Vietnam issue, if that's what results, does in the long run make a settlement more difficult. There, again, are people here who can say much more authoritatively than I on that subject. But, and this does not mean that I don't see any U.S. role in a settlement, let me underscore that. In fact, we have tried to make very clear that we think we have a major role to play in support of ASEAN. That is, we are withholding normalization, we are withholding trade, we are withholding all the potential benefits to Vietnam of peaceful cooperation with the United States until there is a settlement of the Vietnam issue. I think that is a very significant U.S. role, but it is a card for the ASEAN countries to play. I don't believe that if Vietnam comes to think that this is an issue to be settled by directly dealing with the United States, that either Vietnam will be more flexible or, frankly, that it will be more encouraged to realize that it's up against something it can't handle. I think it's come as a surprise to Vietnam that it is confronting, 6 years after its invasion, the unanimous opposition of the ASEAN countries and the strong condemnation of most of the non-aligned countries, strong votes against it in the UN. I think the Vietnamese would love to see this, still try to see this as a continuation of the war in Vietnam, as a continuation of the war with us, as something to be fought in the battlefields of Congress and not to be faced up to as an issue that addresses Vietnam's long-term role in Southeast Asia. And in that regard, I have to say that also as a signal, it seems to me it is a weak signal. And again, I'm prepared to hear different opinions. But this is, we are talking about, I think, perhaps by agreement, something that is largely symbolic, which itself says that it's fairly weak. I think one has to think at least equally of the possibility that Vietnam will react in some way to prove that this kind of thing doesn't intimidate it, to escalate the stakes and to put pressure back on the United States, pressure that I'm afraid could have some damaging effects on the emerging consensus in the United States. And that brings me to the third cost involved here, which is I think this action could jeopardize the U.S. consensus in support of our strategy. And I'd emphasize it's not a static consensus. It's a consensus that has been growing more and more solid in support of ASEAN, in support of, I think, increasingly bold actions in support of ASEAN. And in fact, it's significant, those of you who don't know it, I will mention it, and probably most of you are very well aware of it, that it is Steve Solars who was urging us to do more for the non-communist resistance. It was his subcommittee, with the votes of a number of other liberal Democrats, that voted for this $5 million just a week ago. And I think it is a significant signal to Hanoi and a significant message to the war lovers that the effects of bringing Steve Solars to Hanoi and even getting him to go to Phnom Penh back in December were not what the Thai feared and we, to a lesser extent, feared and tried to discourage him from. They were exactly the opposite. And the effect of their offensive on the border has not been to strengthen their political case, at least not in the United States, but to substantially weaken it. And that's a benefit, and I will say a couple of mildly critical things of Congressman Solars, but I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm glad to be having him attack us from this direction rather than the other direction. It was only little more than a year ago that he told me he would be deeply concerned if we were to move in this direction and would expect to be consulted. So it's quite a change of view on his part, and frankly, I'm much happier to see him coming at us that way. But the consensus is not all that strong, and even in Solars' own case, the motivations are very mixed. And part of the motivation, frankly, in my opinion, is to embarrass the administration on the issue of Nicaragua, which is a deeply, bitterly fought partisan issue, and which many of these positions are leading up to. In fact, one of the things I fear, it's fine now to have a consensus with the Democrats in the lead and the administration sort of reluctantly dragging its heels. If the administration were taking the lead, suddenly this would be defined in a different way. The partisan politics of it would be different. And certainly people like Teddy Kennedy wouldn't speak the way he spoke a few days ago. So I think you have to ask the question, does this kind of action strengthen the American commitment to Thailand security, which is the heart of the issue we're talking about, or does it weaken it? And my fear is that to some extent, by stepping in an area when the need is unclear and the arguments are highly mixed, indeed probably weakens it. The comments by the ranking Republican on the subcommittee, Congressman Leach, opposing Solars' move, and let me emphasize, Leach is a Republican, but he's an extremely liberal Republican. He won't support us on the Philippines, but he will oppose Solars on Cambodia. But if you read his long list of arguments, you will see that there is still a great deal of rather deep unease in the American Congress about military involvements of any kind, and particularly in Southeast Asia. And I think on the whole, because our commitments are important and because we take them seriously, I think we ought to also exercise them in cases of very clear-cut need and exercise them as much as possible on behalf of Thailand and let ASEAN take the lead in supporting the resistance. I've said a lot. I've said taken more time than any of the speakers who kindly kept to their time. But let me just close with a comment on a different subject, because I've noticed in Saracen's excellent paper, and let me emphasize, I'm not trying to urge people not to make these arguments to us. I think the candor of this discussion here is enormously valuable and helpful to us in shaping policy. We don't feel we have the final word. If there's the conflicting opinions that Doug Pike described are very much there, except I don't think they fall on any neat bureaucratic lines. We're all aware that this strategy is that we're supporting, the ASEAN strategy itself, is not an ideal. It's not what everyone would like to see as the outcome. It is the best of a series of not very comfortable alternatives. And that means you have to constantly reassess, and we do constantly reassess. But I also have a question for Saracen on his, and for others who advocate a more active U.S. diplomatic role. I noticed in the same issue of the New York Times that had Kishore's piece in it, there's an article by Robert Manning suggesting similarly that the United States should be more involved. That the argument goes that Hanoi's request for a positive U.S. role in the settlement of Kampuchea has drawn little response from Washington. That is certainly true. And that ASEAN countries or ASEANs felt disappointed about the absence of a more active and imaginative response. And Manning argues that a more active imaginative response would get ASEAN support. I really have some very deep questions about that. I have very deep questions about whether the U.S. should be playing that role at all, whether anyone ever wants us to be the leading negotiator, the leading mediator of this conflict, as opposed to playing a very important role that I've acknowledged we should play of making clear that our relations with Vietnam are contingent on a settlement of the conflict. That is an important, but it's a supportive role. To have us going to Hanoi and playing mediator is something that certainly I wouldn't need a lot of persuasion of. Something you couldn't possibly persuade me of, though, is to argue that now is the time for such an initiative. On the whole, I think now is not a time for diplomatic hyperactivity of any kind. Now is the time to persuade Vietnam that this is not Dien Bien Phu followed by the Paris Peace Conference. This is just one more rainy, dry season in a long series of dismal years that Vietnam will face until it faces up to this problem. And the immediate need is to get the resistance back on their feet and to restore the confidence of Thailand. It's Vietnam that's making these feelers, and it's Vietnam is doing it because what they would like to do is put normalization with the United States ahead of a settlement of Cambodia. I think that's not in ASEAN's interests. I don't think it's in the United States' interests. And I might underscore just in one last comment here, Saracen refers to our obsession with the MIA issue. Indeed, we...